All right. Well, we're in chapter 8, and you figured this out last week, but we've been kind of running behind the 8 ball on this thing. Tomorrow, my plan is we'll do chapter 8 today, we'll do chapter 9 tomorrow. We won't be looking at all of chapter 9. A lot of chapter 9 is Daniel's prayer. We'll just kind of go past that and look at the prophecy of the 70 weeks. Starting to chapter 11, we're just going to go ahead and pass by chapter 10. I'll make a few comments about it, but we'll jump into chapter 11. And then hopefully by Friday, finish up whatever it is we're doing on chapter 11. And then maybe we'll take a peek at the 1290 and 1335. So it gives you a feel for where we're headed. Daniel chapter 8 can be broken up in the following way. We get a setting for the vision in the first two verses, what time period it was, third year of the reign of Belshazzar. Remember that chapters 7 and 8 are right between chapters 4 and 5 chronologically. Chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar's king. Chapter 5, Belshazzar's at the end of his reign. Here in chapter 7 and 8, we're at the first and third years of Belshazzar. So 7 and 8 are chronologically between 4 and 5. Daniel finds himself either in reality or just in vision over in Shushan, also known as Susa, which of course will one day be a capital, one of four capitals at least, of the Persians. But that's significant because he's about ready to see a vision of the Medo-Persian Empire. And he's by this river in verse 2, the river Ulai that ran right there along the west side of the ruins at Susa. So the stage is set. And in verse 3 he says, I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. And this, of course, is that Medo-Persian Empire. It's got the two horns. We can connect that with the two arms in chapter 2, the two sides of the bear in chapter 7. And verse 20 tells us this is the Medes and the Persians of chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 20, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings or kingdoms of Media and Persia. So we're not guessing, we're not making extrapolations from history. We are told who this kingdom is. One of these horns is higher than the other. That, of course, is the Persian power, which rose later, but which came to be the dominant force in the kingdom. Now, verse 4 tells us what this kingdom is doing. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him. Nor was there anyone or any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. In Scripture, in Isaiah 46, for example, the Persian Empire is depicted as coming from the east. Isaiah 46:11, God says He's calling a bird of prey from the east, the man, or Cyrus, who executes my counsel from a far country. Not that Persia didn't go east, but they came from the east, at least from Israel's standpoint. They're going westward from Persia. So this takes them into Babylon, Syria, Asia Minor. They're heading northward into Armenia, maybe the area of Ararat. They're heading southward towards Israel, Egypt, maybe even Ethiopia. And no animal can withstand them. So long as the Persians were in power, they're at this pinnacle of their power, no one could withstand them. That would have been true of any of these kingdoms. But while they're in power, that's true. What they want to do, they did. They had a lot of power and they executed it. Now, Daniel's considering this ram. And as I was considering, he says in verse 5, or observing or thinking about this, some of the translations say, taking it all in, suddenly a male goat came from the west. The ram had come from the east. This male goat comes from the west, across the surface of the whole earth, without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And we know who this male goat is, because the chapter tells us, verse 21, the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. So we're told outright, and it's always nice when we can point to something in Scripture and say, it tells me what it is, and I don't have to try to figure it out. It could be fun to figure it out, but then you end up wondering if you have figured it out. So it's always nice when you have something like this. Now, like we had with the winged lion, we've got a symbol here which may have been familiar to the ancients as a symbol associated with Greece. Remember the winged lion that we saw that went along the sacred way in the city of Babylon? So that when you read about it in Daniel 7, a Gentile might have gone, oh yeah, that's what I would expect with Babylon. Well, the same may be the case here. One source I consulted says the following. About 547 B.C., the Macedonians, upon being threatened with an invasion, became tributary to the Persians. Now, this is before this time. But about 547 B.C., they become tributary to the Persians. And in one of the pilasters, now The pilaster, of course, is one of these column-like things that kind of comes out from the wall, but not entirely. On one of the pilasters at Persepolis, and that Iranian friend of mine, by the way, pronounced that Persepolis, but in one of the pilasters at Persepolis, that very event seems to be recorded. Here's what's there. They have a goat represented with this immense horn growing out of the middle of the forehead, and there's this man in Persian dress standing next to this goat, and he's holding the horn with his left hand. And that's taken by this source, at least, he's suggesting that this is showing that the Persians have exercised power over the Greeks, and the Greek power being this goat with a single horn. So this may have been a very familiar symbol to some people in the ancient world. This horn, this goat's running across the surface of the whole earth, that idea of dominion, and he's doing it without touching the ground, which is an emblem of what?
Speed,
sure. The leopard-like beast in Daniel 7 had four wings. He could fly awfully fast with those. And here he's moving right across the ground quickly. And we talked a couple days ago about the victories of Alexander and how quickly they came. And then, of course, there's this notable horn. And in verse 21, we're told what that notable horn is. That's the first king, that king being Alexander the Great. Now, verse 6. Then he came to the ram. This is the male goat, the Greek kingdom. He came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. So like someone said, he rams the ram, and he does so, it says, with rage. I think your King James says, choler. This word can carry the idea of being embittered, exasperated, enraged against. This is an interesting idea, that the Greek kingdom would attack the Persian kingdom with rage and bitterness. Was that true? Well, it certainly seems to have been from Alexander's standpoint. When Darius was desperate for peace here, he was offering Alexander, here, you can have this big chunk of my kingdom and all this. And Alexander really speaks quite proudly to him, you know. But in one of Alexander's letters to Darius, he wrote the following. Your ancestors entered into Macedonia and the other parts of Greece and did us damage when they had received no affront from us in the cause of it. And now I, created general of the Grecians, provoked by you, and desirous of avenging the injury done by the Persians, have passed over into Asia. So this is how Alexander couched it. You guys attacked us all those years ago when they brought those immense forces at the hands of Xerxes. Yeah, we defeated you over at Salamis and Marathon, and we kept you in check at Thermopylae, and we made ourselves glorious, but you attacked us completely unprovoked, and I'm going bringing it back on your head. So accurately depicted here, if that's the idea. And cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And we remember those things we read about a couple days ago. The victories were considerable. Verse 8, we see what happens to Alexander, the male goat. Therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And we're, of course, seeing the same things here. Alexander dies about 323 B.C. and his four generals, after the Battle of Ipsus in 301, end up dividing the kingdom among themselves. There were four heads in chapter 7. And verse 22 of this chapter, again, we're told what this is about. These four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. So, we've been given a review and maybe a little extra information on the Greeks and the Persians. Any comments or contributions from you before we proceed into an investigation of this new little horn? Yes, Tom.
That's interesting. So we have three chapters, an emphasis of three, on the fact that after this Alexander's out of the way, there'll be four.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yes, Janice.
Is the pilaster with the relief on it updated?
That I do not know. Well, it's supposedly to depict this role they had in 547, but yeah, that doesn't prove when it was done. I don't know. It's a good question. She was wondering if that depiction of the goat with the one horn and the Persian holding it, if that dated back, if we knew when that had been made. And I don't. I know it was at Persepolis, and I know they're thinking that it depicted what happened in 547, but no, I don't know when it was done. So, anything else? Yes, Bill. 323. There may be some other possibilities, but they're not going to deviate from that very much. I don't know that either. I don't know that either. If you have Barnes' commentary, you can just open up to page. Give you the page here as soon as I find it. Open up to page 106, I believe it is, or page 104. I know some of you probably have that commentary at home, and there's a depiction of it there. You can look at it. Anything else? Well, 331 would be more like the beginning of the Greek kingdom, but 323 I think is going to be about the time he dies. What doesn't he? When does he head out of Greece? Something like 334, 336?
Maybe that's
Yeah. All right. Let's pick up here in verse 9 now. And out of one of them came a little horn. So out of one of these four horns, out of one of these four kingdoms, came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. We're going to read the whole chapter here and then come back through it like we did with the seventh. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." Then it happened, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, "Understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end." Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and stood me upright, and he said, "Look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. For at the appointed time, the end shall be. The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. That large horn between his eyes, that is between its eyes, is the first king. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. And the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true. Therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. Interesting. All right. So in verses 9 through 12, we get the part of the vision that pertains to the little horn. Enter Gabriel. And then in verses 23 through 26, we get the interpretation. Let's put it all together and let's see if we can make sense of this. Verse 9, a little horn. A little horn arises, and we are told in verse 23 that that little horn is a king. And we are told that that king is going to arise out of one of those four notable horns, which, just as a reminder, we had some folks who weren't with us last week. Those four notable horns that came out of the Greek kingdom were these. we know that eventually it really came down to these two, Ptolemy in Egypt and Seleucus in Syria. Cleopatra, the one we're so familiar with, was I think maybe one of the last or the last of the Ptolemaic rulers. So the Greek really got boiled down to these two. But it's out of one of the four, we're told. We know from history that this horn came from this kingdom. And almost all expositors, or a great many of them, are agreed that this refers to Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth. And if you've got that, one of the sheets that I gave you, the intertestamental chronology, you can look in your binder. We get a record of these kings. Over here on the left, if you've got it there, you see on the right the Maccabeans, and we'll talk a little bit about them today. You see here in the middle the Ptolemies. Now, they're not matched up according to time, so don't interpret the chart that way. Look carefully at the dates under the name, and you'll see that we're just being given columns. They're not really matched up side by side. But over here on the left are the Seleucids, beginning with Seleucus the First over there in 312 B.C. And if you count eight down, you come to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. According to this chronology, he begins his reign in 175 and ends it in 163. He was, if you're looking at it there, the one just above him, Seleucus the Fourth Philopater or Philopater. That's his older brother, and then the one above it is his dad. So if you want to write, Antiochus the Third is the great. These names can get really just confusing and so forth. Sometimes the extra titles can help. Antiochus III is Antiochus the Great. He's Antiochus Epiphanes' father. And how all that transpires is an interesting study, how Antiochus comes to power. But whatever, anyway. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. And that name he gave himself. Does anyone remember what Epiphanes means? What is that? Close. That's what they called him. Epiphanes means the illustrious. The illustrious. Antiochus Epiphanes took to himself divinity. He was, in fact, the first Seleucid king to use divine epithets on coins. And he liked to be called a god. He regarded himself as the illustrious. The Jews, I'm sure when he wasn't around and when none of his people were around, called him this. Plays on words are an old thing. He calls himself Epiphanes. We call him Epimenes, madman. And that was an appropriate title for him. Let me read to you from 1 Maccabees. This piece of Jewish writing gives us a lot of history about the Jews' dealings with this man. Early on in the book, they write this, that after Alexander's death, all of Alexander's servants put crowns upon themselves, so did their sons after them many years, and evils were multiplied in the earth, and there came out of them a wicked root, Antiochus, surnamed Epiphanes, son of Antiochus the king, that's Antiochus the great, who had been a hostage at Rome. And this is an interesting thing about Antiochus' history. Antiochus the great, his dad, had lost to Rome in 189 B.C. He had lost to Rome in 189 B.C. And the Rome said, okay, you owe us a big chunk of money, and to make sure that you pay us, we want a hostage or hostages. And so Antiochus the great, his dad, ends up sending his son, who's not the rightful heir. He just ends up sending his son to Rome, and Antiochus Epiphanes ends up spending 14 years of his youth from 189 to 175 B.C. in Rome, away from his family, away from his culture. That becomes significant later, and it's only later, in about 175, that he comes home and becomes king. So that introduces the man. That's who we're looking at here in this eighth chapter. Now notice what it says he does in verse 9. He grew exceedingly toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Now, the ram came from the east and went toward the west, but here Antiochus is depicted as going toward the south, the east, and the glorious land. Now, if you go toward the south, you're going towards where? Egypt. He goes towards Egypt. Maccabees bears that out for us, that he had something like maybe three campaigns, maybe even four, although we have no record of a fourth, but a number of campaigns down into Egypt, and some of them, one or two of them very successful. He ended up getting stopped by the Romans, which we may talk about later. And he did go toward the east, towards Persia and the countries of the east. And he went toward the glorious land. And what's the glorious land? Sure, that's going to be Israel. The pleasant land, the beautiful land, depending on your translation. Daniel's the only one who uses this expression. This expression appears here and then over in chapter 11 two times. Chapter 11, verses 16 and 41, Israel's called the glorious land. This is Daniel's term for his holy homeland. And here, and if you'll just bear with me, here is where we really first get introduced to why the Bible has so much to say about Antiochus. We've got a chapter almost devoted to the man, and then we're going to have a whole bunch of chapter 11 devoted to it. And I know some of you, maybe most of you here are associated with this history, but we've got some young enough here that this may all be new. Antiochus Epiphanes played a very pivotal role in the intertestamental period between the Old and New Testament among the Jews. And 1 Maccabees starts giving us a feel for what he did, but this is just the beginning. I'm reading to you from the first chapter of 1 Maccabees. After Antiochus had smitten Egypt, he returned again and went up against Israel and Jerusalem with a great multitude. He entered proudly into the sanctuary and took away the golden altar. So he takes away the altar of incense, the candlestick of light, and all the vessels thereof. He took the table of showbread and the pouring vessels and the vials and the censers of gold and the veil. He goes to the temple, even takes the veil and the crowns. Anybody want to take a stab at what that might mean? The crowns. D.D. says the cherubim. Anybody remember back in Zechariah, in the days of Zechariah? Zechariah was to make a crown or a double crown out of some of the money that had been sent over from the captives or from those over in Babylon. They made a crown and put it on Joshua the high priest to speak of how Jesus would come and be a king priest. That crown, which I think in the Hebrew may be plural, crowns, was put in the temple. And I just came across that today and I thought, I wonder if it's the same thing. Anyway, he took the golden ornaments that were before the temple, all which he pulled off. He took the silver and the gold, the precious vessels. He's doing the sort of thing Nebuchadnezzar did. He took the hidden treasures which he found. And when he had taken all away, he went into his own land, having made a great massacre and spoken very proudly. Therefore, there was great mourning in Israel, in every place where they were. Now, we are just beginning to see what kind of things this man is going to do to them. But you can see now why this is so important. This man's doing what Nebuchadnezzar had done and what others would have liked to have done.
John,
yes.
Is there any connection here with the Antichrist? You heard that he was called the Old Testament Antichrist.
There are those who would make that connection.
Antichrist.
I think the name Antiochus might be associated with Antioch, the city of the area. I'm not sure about that. Does anyone here have something they can add to clarify that? Do you have something, Tom?
Antioch was the capital, and I don't know if that came before the name that they all.
Yeah, I don't have much to offer on that, Dwayne. I don't know that there's anything to that.
AFB mentioned that he was called the Old Testament Antichrist.
Yeah. Well, there certainly are similarities between what we see here, the kind of attitude at least that's behind this, and the kind of attitude we may see in chapter 7 and the sort of thing we see over in the end of Revelation. Someone just warring against God's people. He grows up toward the host of heaven, verse 10. The host of heaven. Isaiah 14:13, God said to the king of Babylon, "You said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God." The man thought a little before he could reach the stars of heaven. That's what the Jewish writer says in 2 Maccabees. These could be referring to his claims of deity, ascending to these high positions. But I think that by host here may just be meant the Jewish people. Notice the statement there in chapter 10. I'll reread verse 10 for us. It grew up, this is Antiochus, to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Now, when we see stars in the Bible, what do they represent? Leaders or just people? Maybe people in positions of authority, but remember, who's the first group of people we see symbolized by stars?
Joseph.
Joseph's got this dream, and here are his 11 brothers, and they are stars. Over in the book of Revelation, when we have the angels to the seven churches, they are depicted as stars. And I think those angels may be humans, because when you have the church to Thyatira, it says to you and to the rest of those in Thyatira. So stars are symbols of people, and I think that might be the idea here. He's going to cast down God's people and trample on them, which he most certainly does, and we'll read more about that here in a little bit. 2 Maccabees 8:2, this is how they spoke of it. They spoke of the people that had been trodden down of all. Now, After plundering the temple, which we just read about in the first chapter, we read this. 2 full years expired, and then the king sent his chief tax collector a tribute into the cities of Judah, who came into Jerusalem with a great multitude. Now this tax collector speaks peaceably to the people, he gets them at ease, but then it says he fell suddenly upon them, smote the city very sore, and destroyed much people of Israel. And when he had taken the spoils of the city, he set it on fire, pulled down the houses and the walls thereof on every side. But the women and the children took they captive and possessed the cattle. And then builded they the city of David with a great and strong wall and with mighty towers, and made a stronghold for them. Antiochus wanted the Hellenization of the Jews. And that's ultimately what we're going to see here. This had been Alexander's dream. Let's see the kingdom all under a Greek influence. And that had been happening down through the centuries, but it's not happening fast enough for Antiochus. His father, the Great, had left the Jews exempt from these Hellenization policies. But Antiochus won't go with that. Yes, Dean?
No, I was just gasping. I didn't realize that.
Came across that in one source. But Antiochus isn't going to have it that way. He's going to try to ramrod this down the throats of the Jews. And so, there's a lot of stuff I could read here. I'm tempted to read some of it, but I know it can be painful for you guys to listen to. Let me read a little bit. Not everyone feels the same way.
John, do you know why the Jews were exempt under his father?
Well, if I'm remembering it correctly and what I read was true, it may just be because that would be the politically wise decision. I mean, the Jews are a stiff-necked people, and they're going to stay with their religion. And I mean, it didn't pay off for Antiochus Epiphanes, and maybe Antiochus the Great was a wiser guy and knew it's not worth it. I'll just let them pay their tribute and leave them alone, and they're not creating any problems for me. What's that? Or God's providence, yeah. Both, perhaps. Let me read to you then some of this, and I'll try to make it as interesting as possible. 1 Maccabees 1. Moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom. Now, this is Antiochus Epiphanes. He wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and that everyone should leave his laws, so that all the heathen agreed to the commandment of the king. Yea, many also of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profaned the Sabbath. So you see what's happening now. The Jews now are going right back into this stuff that they got punished for all those years before. For the king had sent letters by messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple. They even built this tower right next to the temple so that they could look down to make sure that no one came in there and worshiped there. That they should profane the Sabbaths and festival days and pollute the sanctuary and holy people, set up altars and groves and chapels of idols and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beasts, that they should also leave their children uncircumcised to the end that they might forget the law and change all the ordinances. And whoever would not do according to the commandment of the king, he said he should die. Let me read you a little bit more. In the 15th day of the month Casleu, in the 145th year, this is their calendar, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar and built idol altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side. Now, some of you are familiar with that. The abomination of desolation. This took place in June of 168 B.C. Again, the dating in this time period is difficult, and it only gets more difficult the more you try to hammer it out. But 168 B.C., June 168 B.C. perhaps, Antiochus has an altar built on the altar burnt offering. Here's God's real altar, and Antiochus has a new altar built right on it, and this altar is dedicated to Jupiter Olympus. Jupiter Olympus. And he dedicates the temple to Jupiter Olympus. And somewhere along the line, I don't know if it's on this occasion or later, somewhere along the line, he offers swine's flesh, he offers pig flesh, and then he takes the fat or the broth and pours it and or smears it all over the area. And of course, what's that do? The temple's defiled. And no godly Jew is going to try to come in there and worship God until something's done about that. It renders the temple unclean. And then to show you just how far he's willing to go, I keep hearing a hum. Maybe I'm talking too loud. My children tell me I do. Listen to your children, John. In the antiquities of the Jews, written by Josephus. Here's what he writes about this time period. Indeed, many Jews there were who complied with the king's commands, either voluntarily or out of fear of the penalty that was denounced. But the best men and those of the noblest souls did not regard him, but did pay a greater respect to the customs of their country. On which account they every day underwent great miseries and bitter torments, for they were whipped with rods, and their bodies were torn to pieces, and were crucified while they were still alive and breathed. They also strangled those women and their sons whom they had crucified as the king had appointed, hanging their sons about their necks as they were upon the crosses. And if there were any sacred book of the law found, it was destroyed, and those with whom they were found miserably perished also. One aged scribe by the name of Eleazar was flogged to death because he refused to eat pork. A mother and her seven children were butchered after refusing to worship an image. A group that had fled to a nearby cave to observe the Sabbath were caught and burned to death. Two mothers who had circumcised their newborn sons were driven through the city and then cast headlong from the top of the wall. This is real persecution. It's a time in history that doesn't get our attention a lot of the time. But this is what the Jews were enduring in that early 3rd century B.C. And notice what else is said here. Let's keep going. Verse 25, it says of Antiochus that he shall exalt himself in his heart. And he most certainly did to be doing these sorts of things. He starts playing God by telling them who they can worship and how they're supposed to worship, and you're supposed to acknowledge me as a God. It's interesting to read through the Maccabees. I'm just going to give you a quick little tidbits here as you're reading through them how the Jews thought of this man. He entered proudly into the sanctuary. So haughty was Antiochus in his mind. In his pride, we read, but thou shalt receive just punishment for thy pride. He has spoken proudly. Nothing at all had ceased from his bragging, but still was filled with pride. So proud was he. And they're right. That's exactly what this man's problem was. They're, you know, sin has many names, but pride's a handle that fits them all. And this man's just absorbed with his ego. And the Samaritans, it's interesting, this is just kind of an historical aside, but they give the man what he wants. I mean, the Samaritans, of course, you know, they had their temple that was supposedly to God, and they claimed to have a connection here with Jewish history, or at least Jewish faith. But when Antiochus starts doing this and they see what's happening down south, suddenly they start changing their tune. And they start denying that they were related. They start saying that their temple isn't to God. They even write a letter to Antiochus. And they claim in the course of all this, maybe not in the letter, but they claim, we're just a colony of the Medes and the Persians, and we've been misunderstood. And in this letter, they call the Jews wicked, as if those Jews are getting what they deserve. And we've got this temple here, but why don't you just name it the Temple of Jupiter, Hellenius? Look at the compromises these people are doing to save their necks. Remember the book of Revelation, those who please God are those who did not love their lives what? To the death. Here are people willing to sacrifice it all to save their own neck. And at the beginning of this letter, they write to him, to King Antiochus the God. They are willing to compromise in every way. But we've got some Jews down there in the south who won't cave in. And that's a really good story, and we're going to be getting into that here in just a little bit. The daily sacrifices are taken away. Just how long this went on, we don't know. I mean, Josephus talks about how the divine worship had fallen off for 3 years in his antiquities. And then when you go to the wars of the Jews, he talks about how the sacrifice, the temple was spoiled, and the sacrifice... I'll just read you the quote. He spoiled the temple and put a stop to the constant practice of offering a daily sacrifice of expiation for 3 years and 6 months. So it almost sounds like Josephus is maybe disagreeing with himself. And First Maccabees talks about some of this stuff happening for 3 years, and Second Maccabees says 2 years. And it gets really frustrating when you're trying to nail down later parts of the prophecy. But anyway, for a period of time, there's no sacrificing going on in the temple, like the law commanded. The place of his sanctuary is cast down, verse 11, we can see that clearly. And then in verse 12, my New King James says, because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices. Now, I think the New King James may be alone in this translation. Your translation probably says the host, if you're not reading from the New King James, that a host was given over to the horn. The ASV, the host was given over to it. The NAS, the host will be given over to the horn. I don't know why the New King James did what it did, but it seems like it may just be speaking of the host we saw earlier, the Jews. And the Jews are going to be given over to Antiochus. I heard a voice. I thought. Dean?
What it means, but yeah, I have a footnote that says the army. In the NIV, it's translated the host, but then there's a note saying the army.
Yeah. Well, my New King James just says armies right in the text, but it seems to be pretty much alone. It's not apparently the favored translation. Did someone have something you want to say? Was that you, Tom?
It was me.
Okay. All right.
And the Strong's defined Antioch as meaning driven against. And it was the capital of Syria, as you pointed out, founded by Seleucus Nicanor in 300 B.C., named in honor of his father, Antiochus. So it was Seleucus' father, Antiochus, that he named the city after.
Okay.
And then he went west and founded the one in Pisidia.
Okay. Where we see Paul and Barnabas in Acts 13. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
It is good that that's where the disciples were first called Christians, in light of all that's going on here.
Hmm. I'm just sure there was a sound. No one has. Okay, there you were. All right. So this host may just be the people. They're given over to Antiochus. God just gives them over to him since that's the way they want to go. And by so doing, they end up helping oppose the daily sacrifice. I mean, they are in a sense perhaps accountable here that this is happening because of Antiochus' desires, and they're going right along with his desires, aiding and abetting his wicked schemes. And notice verse 12, how it words it. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifice. So what's going on here is because of transgression. Verse 23, notice what it says. In the latter times of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise. Who are the transgressors? I think it may be the Jews. Yes. They built a place of exercise at Jerusalem according to the customs of the heathen, and made themselves uncircumcised and forsook the holy covenant and joined themselves to the heathen and were sold to do mischief. That might sound a little strange. Well, exercise is a good thing. Well, when the Greeks built a gymnasium, this was the place where you went to exercise, but you exercised in the nude. And if you're a Jew and you're trying to look Greek and you go exercise, a male Jew, and you go exercise in the nude, of course, you're circumcised and you look different from the Greeks. Well, we don't want to look different from the Greeks, so what do? Well, Josephus, there's this footnote in my text of Josephus, which is interesting, down at the bottom. The word gymnasium properly denotes a place where the exercises were performed naked, which, because it would naturally distinguish circumcised Jews from uncircumcised Gentiles, these Jewish apostates endeavored to appear uncircumcised by means of a surgical operation. So a surgery was invented to give the appearance that, no, I never was circumcised. And interestingly, Paul might even be alluding to that. 1 Corinthians 7, remember. If talking about how you came into the Christian faith, were you called while circumcised? Do not become uncircumcised. And here's a way in which that's not just theoretical. That's not just in practice. This was something that could literally, in a sense, be done, at least made to appear that way. There is a realization in the Maccabees that the punishment they received from Antiochus came as a result of their sin. And I could read the quotes to you, but I don't know that you want me to take time to do that. But for 1 Maccabees 1:64, there was very great wrath upon Israel. There was a realization, at least at some point, that this was deserved. Verse 12 talks about how he cast truth to the ground. We see that. He did all this and prospered for a time. The enemies of God can prosper for a time, and he certainly did. 1 Maccabees says, he abounded above the kings that were before him. So, here's this prediction of this terrible man who's going to do these terrible things. And the Jews who read Daniel know it's coming. And the natural question that arises now is, how long is this going to last? How long is this going to go on? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? And so that question does get asked in verse 13. Let's reread it again. I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? How long is this going to last? And the answer in verse 14, he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. All right. If you're reading from one of the other translations, you don't have to worry about this first thing I'm going to bring up. But it's an important thing, perhaps, to bring up. And that is that the word translated days in our King James and New King James is not the same word that's translated days elsewhere in the Bible. The Hebrew word for days that we see frequently is this right here, yom. But that is not what we have here in the Hebrew. Instead, what we have are two words. And I'll, if you're a Strong's user, the first one is 6153 and the second one is 1242. And the pronunciation might go a little bit like this, Ereb Boker. Ereb Boker. And that expression, Ereb Boker, is what's behind this translation of days in some of our Bibles. But it's not necessarily, it's a good translation, then again, it's maybe not as specific as we need it to be. Some of the rest of you who have some of the other translations, what does your Bible say? It doesn't say days, what's it say? Evenings and mornings, and that's right. Evenings and mornings. They've added the "and," but evenings and mornings. And it's the exact same expression that appears over in the 26th verse of the same chapter where my translation does say the vision of the evenings and mornings. Now, when you see evenings and mornings, what's that remind you? Sure. And the evening and the morning were the first day. The evening and the morning were the second day. In other words, it seems like perhaps what Scripture has done for us has put an emphasis on a literal day here. Whereas in other passages we might apply the day-year principle, here there looks like there's maybe an emphasis on literal day, evenings, mornings, so that there could be no confusion. Now, I'm not going to be dogmatic about that, but it seems like that may be the indication. And so if you have 2,300 literal days, that gives you 6 years, 4 months, and I believe 20 days. 20 days. A 360-day year. I'm going to go on a 360-day year for the sake of, I guess, maybe ease and consistency. I suppose there might be room to do another day, but we saw 360 seemingly to work before, so that's the one I'm sticking with. 2,300 days. Now, there is another view on this. You won't be surprised. And if someone else were standing up here teaching it, you might be hearing that view espoused. The other view on this is that evenings and mornings isn't meant to be understood as 2,300 literal days, but what I'll call the half and half view, that instead you've got 2,300 somethings, and these somethings are made up of evenings and mornings. So you've got half evenings, half mornings, evenings and mornings, and when you match up the evenings and mornings, because it takes one evening and one morning to make a day, when you match them up, you actually get, instead of 2,300, you actually get 1,150 literal days, which, just do the quick math, is 3 years, 2 months, and 10 days. That might be right. That might be right. But one of these, let's take a look at interpreting these. You're not going to like this. Some of you won't care a whole lot, and some of you it might really bother you, but regardless of which of these you take, we run into chronological problems. And I am not a big numbers guy, despite the fact I'm a little interested in them. I'm not a big numbers guy. I'm not the kind of person who's going to write a book like Tom has written where he goes through all these statistics and so forth. And we need people like that, but I'm not one of those people. And so chronology is of limited interest to me, I admit. I look into it to a point and then I lose interest. But even for people who are more into that than I am, as far as I know, there is no certain answer about the chronology period of this time. Our answers are, our sources are incomplete, and our sources disagree with each other. So as we look at interpreting these, please keep that in mind. I'm not going to be able to give you a for sure starting date and a for sure ending date. And feel free to talk to anyone else you'd like to get more information about that. But I think that's going to be the answer as far as that point goes from anybody. Albert Barnes suggests the following, that the ending date here is when the sanctuary was actually cleansed. And one date that has commonly been given for that is December 25th, 165 B.C. Yes, the day the temple was dedicated. This is where Hanukkah comes from. Some of you I know are familiar with this. When Judas Maccabees, who we'll talk about here in just a little bit, well, I guess now's the time to talk about it. You know, Antiochus is bringing the pressure down on these people. And finally, one day, some of Antiochus's, one of his officers or officers come into the city of Modin. And Judas Maccabeus' father, Mattathias, he's there. He's an influential man in the city. And they come to him and they say, okay, we're having people sacrifice like Antiochus wants us to, and you're a leader in the city. Why don't you come on and do this, and we'll give you gold and all sorts of things. We'll make life real great for you. Well, he says, no. No, I'm not going to turn to the right or to the left. I'm going to serve God. Well, one of the other Jews in town, he comes up ready to make a sacrifice. And Mattathias is so overwhelmed with what we might call zeal, like maybe kind of like a Phineas, he kills the man. Rather than see him sacrifice this terrible sacrifice that's against the law, he kills the man, and then he kills Antiochus' officer, and then basically says, he who is with God, come to me. And they flee the city, he flees out into the mountains, and thus begins this revolt against what Antiochus is doing, which eventually is successful. Did you have something, Dean? And it's a great story. It's one reason why a copy of 1 and 2 Maccabees is worth your time. Just pick up a cheap copy or Google it or something. It's an inspiring story. Men standing for the truth at all costs. And this goes on for some time until finally Mattathias dies. Mattathias or Mattathias, I can't remember which it is. He dies, and before he dies, he puts Judas in control, at least of the military side, because Judas Maccabeus is his name, the hammer. He's a good military leader, and they have all kinds of success against the Greeks, such that the influence is driven out enough that they're able to go back to the temple and rededicate it. And by that time, the gates are burned down. I mean, plants are growing up. And, of course, you've got this altar that's got to be torn down. They tear down, I believe, the old altar of burnt offerings. And they don't know what to do with the stones. They don't throw them away. They put them away hoping a prophet can tell them later what to do with them. But they put up they get it all cleansed. And then on this day, possibly, a rededication begins. And that's when the story goes they had enough oil to keep the lampstand burning one day, and then miraculously it went through for 8 days. And from that you got the Feast of Dedication or the Feast of Lights, which is mentioned in the New Testament. John 10:22, Jesus is in Jerusalem during the winter at the Feast of Dedication. And it's this thing, commemorating this time. Well, if we take this as a starting date, as the end of the 2300 days, when the sanctuary is cleansed, and we reckon back this time, it brings us to August 5th, 171 B.C. August 5th, 171 B.C. Now here's where it gets a little fuzzy. There's nothing I know of on August 5th, 171 B.C. that I can go, here's our starting point for sure. However, is there anything in this general time period which might match up with what we're seeing here? Well, I'll read you what one source says. He writes, "There commenced in the year 171 B.C. a series of aggressions upon the priesthood and temple and city of the Jews on the part of Antiochus, which terminated only upon his death." Let me give you it won't go hand in hand with that, but some things that were going on around this time. And it's going to be kind of a long story, but bear with me. It's a good story. You want to hear it, those of you who like history. A man by the name of Jason was holding the position of high priest in Judah at the time of Antiochus being in power. And by this time, the high priest position had become one of considerable authority, and so men who wanted power wanted to be in the high priesthood. Well, Jason's younger brother Menelaus, there's another way to pronounce that, but I like that pronunciation, Jason sends Menelaus up to Antiochus one day but sends him up there to pay tribute. All right, I've got to pay tribute. You go up there and you handle it. Well, Menelaus gets up there. He's acting as ambassadors for his brother. But Menelaus gets to talk to Antiochus, or at least begins to make a deal with him, and says, "Hey, I'd like to be high priest. I'll pay you 300 talents more than Jason has if you'll make me high priest." Well, Antiochus says, "All right, sure, I'll do that. You're high priest." So Menelaus goes back down to Jerusalem, tries to assume this power, but Jason's got enough people on his side that Menelaus can't do it. Menelaus goes back up to Antioch and he tells Antiochus, I'm having some trouble. You need to know that I will go over to the religion of your religion and the worship of the Greeks. Well, this is just exactly what Antiochus wanted to hear. You mean I can have a man in power who's going to be pushing this? You got it. So Antiochus helps him to go back down there and finally assume the high priesthood. This is happening in about 172 B.C. So now we've got a man who's willing to push the Jews towards apostasy right around 172, maybe early 171. Now Menelaus makes good on his promise. One historian writes, he made good on it by, quote, apostatizing from the law of Moses to the religion of the Greeks and all their rites and usages and drawing as many others after him into the same impiety as he was able. So he gets this thing started, but one problem. Menelaus doesn't pay that money. He was supposed to pay this money to Antiochus. What was that, Butch? Okay. He was supposed to pay money, and he didn't pay it. So Antiochus says, did you say something, Dean? Am I hearing things? Or? Oh. All right. I'm hearing myself humming. I'm just. Can you still hear me? Yeah, not a problem, John. Okay, so Menelaus gets called back to Antioch. Antiochus says, you haven't paid me that money. Well, you need to have a little talk. So Menelaus goes up there, but he wants to hold on to power, of course. He gets up there, and Antiochus isn't in town. Antiochus has been called over to handle an insurrection over in Tarsus. Tarsus in one other place. And so when Menelaus gets there, being in trouble, Antiochus isn't there. So he's got some time. He wants to get that money, so everything will be okay. So what's he do? He steals articles out of the temple and starts selling them. He sells some to Tyre. He sells them to other places. And then Antiochus isn't there, but Antiochus has got a man named Andronicus in power. And Antiochus says, here, Andronicus, and gives some of to him, trying to get in good to hold on to his power. So you see what we have now. And this is 171 B.C. now. We're near this time. We have a man who is in the power, a religious power, willing to lead the people in apostasy, drawing them in that direction. And now he's pillaging the people's temple. He himself is doing it. There's a man by the name of Onias, who maybe had been high priest himself, who's living in Antioch because Antiochus won't let him leave. Onias hears what Menelaus has done. Onias rebukes him for it. Menelaus doesn't like that. He talks to Andronicus, and Andronicus goes and murders Onias. So now a man who's standing for the truth has been murdered up in Antioch. This might be a part of this beginning. The high priest leading the people in apostasy, the selling and plundering the temple himself, this man standing for the truth, getting killed. I mean, this in some way may be connected. And it is right around this time in the general vicinity. So some of that might be connected to what we're looking for. Got about 5 minutes. Let's take a peek, just real quick, at this interpretation. If you take this one, 3 years, 2 months, 10 days, you're not going to get anything exact. But one possibility would be while the temple is in disuse, which might have run from about 168 to 165 B.C. As I pointed out to you, there's those dates from Josephus. He says 3 years in one place, 3.5 years in one place. And he might be speaking of slightly different things there, but you know, if he's talking about the same thing, you've got 3 years here, 3.5 there, maybe that falls right in the middle, and you get what you're looking for. We just don't have exactly all the information we'd like to have. We are told in verse 23 now that all this is going to go on in the latter time of their kingdom. Yes? I don't.
I was thinking that was 168.
When Mattathias killed the priest?
Yeah, or killed him?
Well, that's an interesting thought. Okay. Tom's thinking the year that Mattathias killed that man who was going to sacrifice and the official of the Greeks, that happened in 168 B.C., which might go hand in hand with this second interpretation. I had not considered that angle. Anything else? Verse 23 said it's going to happen in the latter time of their kingdom. The Greek kingdom started in 331 B.C. The Seleucid kingdom fell to Pompey in 63 B.C. So if you do the numbers, 160 years plus have passed. If you date it from the 160s, 160 plus years have passed. We've maybe got about 100 to go. So they are well into the second half of the history of their kingdom. So that fits the latter time of their kingdom, if that's what's intended there. Verse 23 talks about how he understands sinister schemes. We've seen plenty of that. And there's some more. And I'll read one quote to you from 2 Maccabees. We're just about out of time. 2 Maccabees 5. Antiochus sent also that detestable ringleader, Apollonius, with an army of 22,000, commanding him to slay all those who were in their best age and to sell the women and the younger sort, who coming to Jerusalem and pretending peace, did forbear till the holy day of the Sabbath, when taking the Jews keeping the holy day, he commanded his men to arm themselves, and he slew all them that were gone to the celebrating of the Sabbath, and running through the city with weapons, slew great multitudes. So let's take advantage of them. We'll come in, hey, everything's okay. Sabbath day rolls along. Here the Jew is resting, observing the Sabbath. Kill him. So this deceit and cunning is certainly fit. It fits. Verse 25. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart, shall destroy many in their prosperity. Some of your translations say, he shall destroy many while they are at ease, or while they feel secure. And that Sabbath day thing might fit that perfectly. Here we're just observing the Sabbath, and lo and behold, Apollonius falls upon us. Let's close with the close of his life. Notice what it says here at the end of verse 25. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. 1 Maccabees 6, and you won't have to listen to me read this stuff much more. Also that they had pulled down the abomination. He's being told what's going on down in Jerusalem. He's off in the east. I think maybe he's at Babylon at this point. He's been trying to undertake some military excursions out there. He's in Babylon, and he gets word now what's going on in Jerusalem, the success that Judas Maccabeus and so forth are having. He gets word that they had pulled down the abomination which he had set upon the altar in Jerusalem, that they had compassed about the sanctuary with high walls as before, and his city Bethsura. Now when the king heard these words, he was astonished and sore moved, whereupon he laid down upon his bed and fell sick for grief, because it had not befallen him as he had looked for. And there he continued many days, for his grief was ever more and more, and he made account that he should die. Wherefore he called for all his friends and said unto them, the sleep is gone from mine eyes, and my heart faileth for very care. And I thought with myself, into what tribulation am I come, and how great a flood of misery is it wherein now I am? For I was bountiful and beloved in my power. But now I remember the evils that I did at Jerusalem, and that I took all the vessels of gold and silver that were therein, and sent to destroy the inhabitants of Judea without a cause. I perceive therefore that for this cause these troubles are come upon me. And behold, I perished through great grief in a strange land. So Antiochus died there in the 149th year. And I believe 2 Maccabees tells us how his death involved worms, which reminds you of who? Herod. The voice of a god and not of a man, and a similar form of death. I appreciate your attention very much. We'll plan to pick up in chapter 9 tomorrow.